my name's Carolina. I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Carolina.
Hi, everyone. It's great to be here tonight. We had such a lovely write-up, the sunset on the mountains. I mean, it's just so beautiful. And then I think they call this area God's country. It just really is, you know. But I think every meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous is God's country, actually. Because I think this is where I get connected to you, and you have the light, you know, and together we each bring a little bit of the God that's within each one of us. And when we come into, you know, a room together, it kind of like exponentially grows and we recover. And it's pretty amazing. So I'm really grateful to be at an AA meeting. My sobriety date is August 1st, 2000. Jerry Garcia's birthday, I believe. It's very exciting. I didn't plan it that way. It just happened. Because I was in a treatment center. Was it treatment center? No. I think I had gotten arrested and I was getting ready to go to my first two-week detox, my second two-week detox in 2 months. And it was like, I remember thinking, okay, that was the day that like I went into the facility, the psychiatric ward, for 2 weeks. So yeah, I think I remember just, they said, you know, pick a date, and I'm like, okay, I think that's it, you know. So anyway, it worked. August 1st, 2000, and thank God that that's been then, and today I'm sober just from a daily reprieve contingent on my spiritual condition, you know. It's just a daily thing, and but I forget that sometimes. Anyway, I have a sponsor, and her name's Karen C. She lives in New Jersey. I lived there for about 4 years, and I sponsor other women. And that saves my behind on more times than I can even count on as many fingers as I have so many times. And what else? Oh, I have a home group, Outlaw Safecracker Group in Richmond, Virginia. And we meet on Mondays and Thursdays at 7 p.m. So feel free to come out, check us out. We'd love to have you anytime you're in the Richmond area. My sobriety, you know, my story is, just never changes. It's the same thing every time. I get sick of it sometimes. I'm like, maybe because something happens, so it could be like something different. It's the same thing. I remember I was asked to speak at my home group when I had just relocated back to Richmond from New Jersey about a year and a half ago. And I had just joined the Outlaw Safecracker group, and they asked me to speak. And my daughter was in the car with me, and she was sitting in the back seat. And, you know, I have Bluetooth on my, and I have, you know, the fancy Bluetooth speaker where you hear your phone. So this guy was talking to me and asking me to speak. And then when he hung up, my daughter said, well, Mai, what are you going to speak about? And I said, I don't know. And then there was this long pause. And then I knew her wheels were going, you know. And then a few minutes later, she's like, well, I know. Why don't you talk about how you survived with God? Yeah, she was 6 years old at the time. Yeah, and I was like, whoa, right? Like, how amazing. I mean, it just gave me goosebumps all over, you know, because she was like spot on, you know. And I haven't sat down and talked to her. She's seven now, and I haven't, you know, had to sit down and say, Mommy's an alcoholic. And, you know, she just knows that there's lots of women that come in and out of my house that are her friends, too. And she just, you know, she just sees and hears a lot of God, which I'm so grateful for, because when I first came into this program, I wanted nothing to do with God. I absolutely wanted nothing to do with God. And I was really pissed when I saw the steps on the wall and it said something about God in it. And I was like, oh, there we go. And I knew there was a catch to all this, you know. Because I thought I had dealt with the God thing. I thought I'd put God away in a little box, and we didn't need to deal with that anymore. But I came here into these rooms, and you guys said, no, we're going to talk about God. And I was like, but today I'm not like that, you know, and that's really cool, and that's only as a result of the steps. But I'll share a little bit about how I survived with God, you know, and I think that was in the reading that you just read, right? Our stories are basically just a description of how each of us have established a relationship with a higher power that keeps us sober today, you know. So I had started to have a relationship with a higher power when I was about at the same time that I had my first drink, so about 13. My mom was Catholic, my dad was Episcopalian. We were always going back and forth to either church. They could never make up their minds. But we always went to church, and I hated church. But I was starting to kind of like get it, like a little bit, like, oh, maybe there's like some peace in this. I was starting to have like some experience with that. And it was about the same time when I had my first drink. I was born in Ecuador in Latin America and moved up here when I was 5 years old. And when I was five, that was the first time in first grade, it was the first time I remember being not a part of, feeling completely different because I did not know the language, you know. And I remember all the little kids stood up to do the Pledge of Allegiance and I had no freaking clue what they were doing, you know. And, you know, if you see a kid and they don't know the pledge, it's not a big deal. In my mind, it was a big deal. You know what I mean? So I know that I've had this disease since before I ever touched a drop of alcohol because I automatically always felt different. And that was a moment for me in my life when we first moved to the United States that I was like, yep, I'm different. I don't know this, I don't know that, I'm not good enough, everybody's talking about all this different stuff and I don't even know it, and I'm just learning the language. So then all growing up, you know, it was just a matter of trying to get attention, trying to get things to make me feel better, I was stealing dolls from my mom, from her little stash of like birthday presents for kids, you know, I was stealing dolls like already, like in the fourth grade. You know, my mom was busting me and I'd be like, no, I didn't. You know, I'm already lying. You know, I'm already lying. And I'm like 8 years old. And that's just who I am without a spiritual solution, you know. But around 13, as I was getting introduced to a spiritual way of life, I found alcohol. You know, we went back to Ecuador every summer. My mom would take us every summer. I was with my cousins. We're at a party, you know, my family had lots of parties. There was a lot of alcoholism on both sides of my family. And, you know, drinking was just a part of what we did. Parties were just a normal part of our life, I thought, you know, that's just what everybody does. So when all the adults went away, my cousins and I went down the table and, you know, raced to see of all the leftover drinks, who gets to the end of the, you know, the table first, drinking all of it. And I remember feeling like I had entered a new dimension, you know. I didn't necessarily feel prettier or any of those things that people talk about. But I just felt like I entered a new dimension, like kind of like a carnival world, you know, where everything got very interesting. Even like the trees outside, like were very interesting. You know, it's kind of like an acid trip almost, my first drunk. And I loved it. We got busted. One of my cousins threw up. The other cousin peed in her pants. I didn't do either. So I was like, yes, I've got this. I found my thing. I didn't drink immediately, daily drinker from there, right? But, you know, whenever I got the chance, once I got to be 14, 15, whenever we had alcohol and I could get it, that was my aim, you know, to have that feeling again, to feel in that new dimension where everything was okay for a little while and interesting. Because it wasn't. My life didn't feel very interesting at all because I just felt like I was never good enough. I was different, and I was at the bottom of the totem pole compared to everybody I saw. Because I wasn't one of the cool kids at school. I wasn't a jock or a cheerleader or, you know, anything. I was just kind of, you know, mixed in with the other people that didn't fit into any of those groups, and we made a little group. That was us. And we found alcohol, you know, and so that's what we did. We drank. One of those friends died from this disease a few years ago, and really sad, you know. Had a couple of kids. These kids are running around at the funeral. It was just, like, so sad. But that's what this disease does. And I had a lot of fun. I mean, there was a lot of fun. I partied. We partied. We had a lot of good times. I was starting to put myself in compromised situations from the get-go, from when I was 15 years old on, you know, and it usually had to be with men, you know. That's just my story. Alcohol and men do not go well for me. And that's all I did. But, you know, I drove drunk. And, you know, I'd get busted a few times, you know, and I would lie. I'd always be lying. Lying is like my go-to, you know, always has been. Dishonesty is big. And it's one that, with God's help, is really turned, you know, turned quite a corner for me. But it can still come up. That's why we have the 11th step to, on, you know, and the 10th step, right? To watch out for that dishonesty. Because for me, I know once I'm starting to be dishonest, man, you know, it's we're going not good places, you know. So, one thing that I did, I had my first real resentment. Fueled by my alcoholism and by my fear, my self-centered fear, when I was about 16 and I had been doing ballet my whole life. Loved it. I was going to be a professional ballet dancer. And I got a resentment against the woman who ran the ballet thing because she told me to lose weight, you know. And I made a snap decision one day in ballet class. You know, now this was going to be my deal. This was going to be my profession. I loved it. I danced 6 days a week. I mean, I loved it. And one day I copped a resentment. I was really pissed at this woman. And I was just in ballet class. I'm going to quit. I'm going to show her. I'm going to quit. And I did. I quit. Done. You know, just like that. I hadn't thought about it for more than 2 minutes. And I was done. And I left that studio that day, and I never went back. And what did I do? I went straight to drinking, you know. I went straight to drinking. And I know that I crossed the line into alcoholism somewhere around 16, 17 because the obsession was on me, you know. Now I had free time. I had freed up 6 days of the week. It was like, sweet. Right? Now I can drink the way I want to, anytime I want to. I've got plenty of time. And that's what I did, you know? And the obsession was on. I was always into looking good. That has been my thing my whole life. It all has to look good on the outside. Everything has to look good on the outside so you will not even question me, right? So you'll think that I'm good enough. And you won't, you're not, and I won't let you in. To see who I really am, because if you see who I really am, you're going to leave me. You're not going to like me. And so my whole deal at that time was to look good. So that meant good grades, right? Okay, the ballet thing didn't work out, but I'm getting really good grades, right? Yeah, you know, and doing this and doing that. I was just, you know, putting up all these store windows, you know, making them all look really nice, like Macy's at windows at Christmas in New York, you know. Making them look really nice so that you couldn't question what I was really doing, you know. And what I was really doing was stealing money from my dad's wallet, stealing liquor from the liquor cabinet, you know, lying, cheating, and, you know, doing all sorts of things. And, but, you know, I was putting up a really good front. That's just what I do. I'm excellent at it. And that's what I did, put up a really good front and went off to college. And when I got into college, I got the nickname Norm. Remember Norm from Cheers? Yeah. I got the nickname Norm because we were in a co-ed dorm in Virginia Tech. And my buddy was in the next floor down over to the left. I can still remember. And I would just always be in his dorm room drinking in the same spot every day, you know. And you know, it's just what I did. It was like, oh, I'm free now. Just like when I quit ballet, right? Oh, I'm free now to do what I want to do. You know, the selfish self-centeredness was so, it was all about me, you know? And, you know, I was like, oh, now I've written my parents off. Ooh, good. I don't have to worry about them anymore, right? I don't have to worry about coming into the house drunk. I don't have to worry about my breath stinking. I don't have to worry about keeping up with all my lies. Now I can just live the life, you know. In the first couple semesters, I did well. Then I got introduced to some dry goods that are outside issues in Alcoholics Anonymous, but they come in the green form, and then they came in a white form, and then they came in all sorts of different forms. And I really got into that scene, you know, because, and now I know today, because when I first came into AA, I was like, well, should I go to AA or should I go to NA? I don't know. Am I an alcoholic? Am I a drug addict? I don't know. I'm all of them. And now I know that I was a daily drug user because I used that to manage my alcoholism. Because I did those drugs so that I wasn't so sloppy all the time. Because drinking, I just passed out. I just passed out anywhere. At rock concerts and arenas many times, whoop, just go back, fall back, hit concrete walls, you know. I would fall at parties, you know, just be sitting on a couch and do a shot, and next thing you know, I'm on the floor, you know. And there was one time at a bar where I had a seizure, you know, and they had to put their, you know, finger in my mouth because, so I didn't, I guess, bite my tongue or whatever it was. But yeah, so I was having all these things happen. And every time one of those things happened, I'd be like, oh, yeah, that was kind of bad. Okay, so I'll just do this instead, right? So I would do a different combination of, you know, drugs or whatever to combat the alcohol. And I just kept getting in these situations in college where I was becoming more remorseful, and I was starting to become ashamed of the things I was doing. It was, you know, but the only alcohol was my solution. I didn't know any other solution. So every time one of these really embarrassing things happened to me, I would just drink again. You know, I'd say, well, let's just move some things around. Let's shift some things around. And definitely I need some relief. You know, by the time it got to be about 5 or 6, it was like, all right, what are we doing? You know, where's my stash? Where are we drinking? Where are we going? I was a bar drinker. I helped many poles stay standing, you know, helped, you know, lean against the pole, support the whole building, because everything was spinning, you know, and I cheated on boyfriends. You know, I did all of that, lied, cheated, got in a fight with a woman, put her on a restraining order. I mean, I did some crazy stuff, but what was going on within me is really what's more important, which was I was starting to lose sight of who I was. And as I looked in the mirror, started looking in the mirror towards the end of my college years, I just, every time I'd look in the mirror, I just didn't know really who was looking back, you know? And it was this hollow feeling inside. Just this like, oh, who is that? What's happening? I'm scared, but I don't even know I'm scared, you know? But I'm just full of fear all the time. But again, my only solution is alcohol. That's my only solution, so I just keep doing it. You know, what else am I going to do? There's nothing else to do. So I start having panic attacks and all this stuff is happening. My parents have me come back to Richmond. I go to the therapist. The therapist tells me to go to Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm 20 years old. I'm like, I don't think so. You're crazy. You're talking about alcohol, AA? Like, I didn't know anything about AA, but of course I knew everything. You know, I was like, no. This night, just give me the medicine. Give me my pills. The ones that say do not drink with them. Yeah, those pills. Give me those. And she said, well, why don't you not drink for a month and see how that goes? So I didn't. So December of 1999, I did not drink for a month. And I'm going to use this just to check the time. Okay, good.
There's a clock.
Oh, perfect. Thank you. So, you know, it was December 1999. I did not drink for a month. Now, I do think I still, like, did some stuff, like, I don't know, snorted Ritalin or something. But that was sober to me, you know, at that time. So for 4 weeks, I did not drink, and they were miserable weeks. And I remember it was New Year's Eve, and I went with a boyfriend at the time and a few other people. We were in Richmond, and we just, like, rented a – oh, and my boyfriend had gotten caught doing stuff in New Orleans, and he was, like, on getting ready to go to prison or something. It was just not – not exactly what a ballerina, you know, little straight A, I wasn't straight A, but I was AB student, you know, not what you think I would be at 20. But I'm in this hotel, like a Super 8 or something on Broad Street in Richmond, and it's New Year's Eve and we're just drinking. And we're just in that room, just drinking and like miserable. Can't even make it to the lobby of the Super 8 where maybe they had a party. I don't know. But, you know, you couldn't even make it to the lobby. Just sit there and drink. And I drank that night, and I remember drinking that night, and I woke up the next morning, and I was hungover, and that morning I knew, like a cloud settled over, you know, me for the next 6 months, which was obviously I was going down, you know, my path. I was on my way to my bottom. I didn't know it at the time, but I did feel a sense of doom, you know, like, oh, something isn't right here. I couldn't put it together that it was my drinking, that I had a problem with drinking. I didn't know. I had no idea. But I just knew, like, things weren't right. So I go back to school on these new meds, and I'm drinking and doing my dry goods. It's a hot mess. And somehow I end up graduating that year, and it was because I went from a degree in the business school. I had changed to the easiest program in the college to graduate from, you know. I don't even know how to explain it today. It's called resource management. If anybody in the audience knows what resource management is and they'd like to share with me after the meeting, I'd be happy to share, to hear what you have to say about it. I have no idea what I graduated in. Because most of the classes I was in, I was drunk or, you know, in a brownout. I was definitely on dry goods all the time, 24/7. So I don't remember much. But I graduated. Really funny story. There was this in my daughter's elementary school right now in Richmond. This woman came across. She was like in the PTA, and I walk in and I'm like, ooh, I know her. Sure enough, she knows me from college. I have no idea how I know her, though. And I have not been, like, humble enough to go to her and be like, how do we know each other again? Because I think maybe she was in my degree class in college, but I was so messed up in all of those classes. I don't know. I don't know how I know her. But I know her, you know. It was one of those moments. I was like, oh, man, I'm still having those moments. But anyway, so I graduate with the easiest degree, and I say to myself, well, I've been through that 6 months. It was so hard. You know, I'm just partying those last 6 months. You know, oh, so difficult. I need to take time off. Now, most people who graduate from college, I was on the five-year plan. Even on the five-year plan, most of them are getting interned or have a job set up that they're going to go to and, you know, start working, and that is not my plan. My plan at this point is I need to take a month off and party because I've been through a lot, you know. So I got to take a month off. So I was like, the month of June, I'm going to take the month of June off. And I took it off, and I took off. So what happened to me basically is I, you know, followed Fish around, this band that's like the Grateful Dead. And, you know, just got in a lot of unsafe situations. But that was my thing. You know, once I start drinking, I can't tell you where I'm going to end up. I can't tell you where I'm going to end up, who I'm going to end up with, what I'm going to do, what I'm not going to do. I just can't. All bets are off, you know, and I can't live sober. That's a problem for me at this point. Living sober is not even an option. I can't do it. I did it for 4 weeks. It was freaking awful, you know. So at this point in my drinking, it's like, sober is not an option, and then my behavior just got worse and worse and worse and worse, you know what I mean? And at this point, you know, it was just really crazy, and I lost touch with reality, you know? I did just a lot of those dry goods and enough of them in a combination that I was in a psychosis, and driving from Atlanta to Raleigh and Raleigh to here, and driving around Raleigh for 12 hours, you know, on that loop. I was stuck on the loop for a long time. And, you know, it was just, I was out there. And, you know, my friends were trying to take care of me. They couldn't take care of me anymore. I went to my first Tucker's in Richmond, you know, for to dry out, I guess, for 5 days. In that time, I had no idea why I was there. I was in one of those rooms that didn't have the knob on the inside door, you know, and like a little window that's like this, you just peer out of. And I remember peering out at times and looking, they'd be making my lunch and putting like vinegar or something on it. I'm like, they're putting LSD in my lunch. I know it. I know they're just keeping me messed up. I just know it. You know, I thought I was backstage at Fish at Tucker's. When I graduated to the group program where you have knobs and you can go freely, apparently I have no recollection, I stripped down naked and started running around the floor. And they said, well, she's not ready yet. Back up to the other floor with some more supervision. So I get out of there at 5 days. And meanwhile, you know, I'm so self-centered and inconsiderate of what this is doing to my family and to my mother. My mother was in Ecuador at the time when all this happened. She had to fly back, you know, make sure I was okay. My dad had mental health problems. He was a dry drunk, and he had suffered from terrible depression and mental health problems. He was a hot mess. She came back, had to deal with him, had to deal with me and Tucker's. And the minute I get out of Tucker's, what do? See you, Mom. I'm going back to Blacksburg. I mean, I think it was the same day. I don't remember. But I think it was the same day or the next day. I was in the car, and I was back to my friends, you know, back. That is the obsession. That is the obsession. That is when the disease is on me, and it has got me. And there's absolutely nothing that is going to get in the way of me and a drink. There's absolutely nothing. No, you know, in the book it says no human power could have relieved us of our alcoholism. And there's absolutely no human power that was going to relieve me of my alcoholism then. You know, there was nothing that was going to get in my way. I know how to manipulate, lie, cheat, steal my way to getting what I want. And I do it every time. And I've done it sober, too, by the way. Yeah, but not to drink, just to get my way. But anyway, so go back to Blacksburg. Obviously, once I start drinking, I remember taking that drink and going, I really shouldn't be doing this. Like, why, you know, my crazy psychotic brain at the time I'm drinking, I'm going, you know, it talks about in the book, he says, I vaguely sensed I wasn't being any too smart. I vaguely sensed. Yeah, the insanity is like, you know, it's like, you know, once it started going down, immediately I transitioned to insanity, you know, and into the like, oh, well, you know, the efforts and here we go. Right. Here we go. So I did that. That reignited the psychosis again. So this time after I'm drinking there for a couple of days, my mom goes back to Ecuador. She thinks everything's fine because, again, I can put up a really good front. Make you look like everything's just fine. I'm good. And she goes back to Ecuador. I go back to Blacksburg. I start drinking again. And in short order, I'm walking around to different people's houses saying that the unicorns told me to go there, you know. And I go into strange people's houses and I'm petting them. I mean, I'm not making this up. Like, literally, I'm just walking around. I'm hearing voices in the car. I mean, I'm driving. Scary. You know, I'm in the car and the radio, and I'm hearing voices, you know, and the voices are telling me, go to this house, go to this place, and I'm walking in, you know, and I'm petting people. And, you know, things are, like, not going too great, but I'm, like, I'm seeing this whole underworld, like, I'm, like, in some sort of other dimension, like, you know, like, these unicorns are telling me where I gotta go, and it was just crazy, and then I'm at a bar, right, because I always end up at a bar, and I had manipulated my friends to say, okay, take me to this bar, because at this point, my friends are trying to just, like, corral me, you know, like a wild, you know, banshee, you know, just like, oh God, okay, come here, stop there. And so they said, Carolina, we'll make a deal with you. You, we'll take you to a bar, but don't drink. You know, these people were like daily drinkers, daily users, you know. I mean, they were like, I was like, what are you telling me? You're worse than I am. You know, and they're saying, if you don't drink, when we get back home, you know, you can have a little bit of this other stuff, okay? But you have to not drink. Okay, yeah, tell an alcoholic to go to a bar and not drink. Yeah, right. Didn't work for me. So I'm there, I'm restless, I'm irritable, right? I'm crazy. And I'm like, I'm thirsty. I got a drink. I've got to get a drink. I can't drink. They're telling me I can't drink. I got a drink. And so I just make it over, you know, the pool table's over there, and I'm just kind of going over to the bar, you know, just trying to inch my way over. I'm trying to get a drink, not able to get a drink. And then there are these four men there. And they say, hey, you know, we've got alcohol. We got other stuff, too. Come along. And I think they're the four band members of Phish. I really did in my psychosis. So I'm like, sweet. I'm going with the band to go, you know, get loaded. Sweet. You know, I didn't think twice about leaving. Didn't think twice. So I went with these four men, and I was gone for 2 days, you know. And there was a moment there where I didn't know these men, you know, and they were just, you know, I don't know where they were from, Central America somewhere, maybe Latin America. They were, you know, your daily sort of landscaping type of guys, you know. And yeah, it was a horrific couple of days. And I tried to leave, you know, and I couldn't. And they wouldn't let me, and I couldn't, and it was not a good situation. And what happened was my dad had called the FBI. I don't know how he did that, but to get you know, to find me, and my mother's had to come back from Ecuador again. This is the second time, and they're looking for me. They can't find me. These guys are like taking me to different places to like avoid the cops. And they take me to this hotel room, and it was awful. And I do remember when I was in that hotel room, they had gotten me a can of maybe Pabst Blue Ribbon, and it was really bad, you know, pot. And I remember thinking, like, I was very prideful in what I drank. I drank only craft beers, only the best wines. You know, I had no money. I just stole the money from my parents, or I went to the pawn shop, you know. And, you know, I only had the best pot. I grew it. I mean, it was just like this. I was just the best, you know, only the best for the best. And here I was in this awful situation with these four men. And there it is, a can of Pabst Blue Ribbon and that awful pot. And I am in the most horrific situation I can imagine for that point in my life. And I had a lucid moment of going, well, look at that. Look at where I have ended up. You know what I mean? This is where I have ended up. And they eventually dropped me off in the campus of Virginia Tech. I petted some more people in some dorms. I was half clothed, and I got arrested. Thank God. They arrested me, took me to the hospital, got me checked out. And then put me in the two-week stint at St. Albans Hospital in Radford, Virginia, in the psych ward. And that was, you know, that was a crazy time. I was in the back of that car flipping, like doing somersaults, trying to get out of the cop car. I mean, I was just crazy, just insane. So, you know, obviously my mom comes to see me. My mom is begging me to go to rehab while I'm at the psych ward. And I am saying, no, no way, man. I remember being in the hallway on the payphone, calling my friends, telling them to get me out of there and get me to a drink. I need a drink. I need relief now. I didn't know I needed relief then, right? But I know now. I needed that relief. I needed a drink. And I was just constantly on that payphone trying to get people to come get me out of there. Nobody would get me out, you know, thank God. Then my mother got somebody from Alcoholics Anonymous who tried to help my father, and my father wouldn't do this program. And so he called me, and I don't know what he said, but something he said made me finally say, you know what, I'll do rehab. I'll just do it. I'll go to rehab. Fine. My first surrender. That was my first surrender that I was willing to do something other than Carolina's plan. And thank God for that. So I went to rehab, and I did a lot of crazy things in rehab too. Like I tried to fake my suicide so I could get out of there. I mean, and then they took me to the local psych ward there in Maryland, and they said, do you want to go here or do you want to go back to the nice, cushy treatment center? I'm like, oh, I'll go to the treatment center now, you know, because when the disease is on me, I've got to get it, you know, and I wanted to get out of there. I had to get out of there. I just needed relief so badly. And but in that treatment center, I would say what was good about it is I got an introduction to Alcoholics Anonymous. And I got an introduction to the fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous because they would bring meetings into that treatment center. And I had never felt like I belonged like I felt in that meeting ever in my life. I felt like, oh, my God, these people get me. A, I'm not crazy because these people say I'm not crazy. I'm not bad. I'm a little crazy. But, I mean, I have the disease of alcoholism. That's what's wrong with me. I'm not nuts, you know. I just have a disease. And then I just felt like, oh, and I'm in a group of people who get it. They just get it. You know what I mean? Like, nobody in my life really got me. I didn't get me, for crying out loud. But these people got me more than I got me, you know. And that was the first time I'd ever felt that in my whole life. And I said, huh. There's something to this. That got my attention. And then I saw God on in the steps, and I said, oh, great, you know, here we go. I knew there was a catch. This is all real nice, but now I realize this is a God thing. You're going to turn me into a Jesus freak. And I'm just not up for doing that at 21 years of age. But you know what? At that treatment center, I also found out I was pregnant. And I couldn't tell you who the father was or if it was those four men. I have no idea to this day. And that was my jumping off point. See, in the treatment center, I was still balking at this. I was still have one foot in, one foot out. I was still like, no, but you don't guys don't get me. I'm different. This isn't really for me. I wasn't there until I found out I was pregnant. And then everything came rushing back to me. Everything that had happened that summer, everything. And I said, oh, my God, right? It was baffling to me how I had gotten to that place in my life at 21 years of age. That is horrifying it was for me. It was not at all what I thought I'd be when I was 21 years of age. And that was enough to scare the living daylights out of me. And that fear kept me sober for a good while in Alcoholics Anonymous. I'd say a couple months. You know, came back to Richmond. I did everything. I had the gift of desperation. You know, and I'm so grateful that my higher power had that little baby inside of me for that very little bit of time that that baby was there, because God knew exactly what I needed to get to a point of being willing to do whatever it is that you guys asked me to do here in Alcoholics Anonymous. And for me, it was that. For other people, it doesn't have to be. For other people, it can be, you know, whatever it is. But for me, I am hard-headed, stubborn, and defiant. Defiant, and it took that little baby. So I said, okay, I have this little baby. I'm going to keep it because I was raised Catholic and Episcopalian, and I'm going to keep the baby, and it's going to keep me sober. And at 3 months in, I started to go to meetings every day. I mean, I was willing. You know, I was desperate willing. Meeting, 90 meetings in 90 days, got a sponsor, got a home group, got the coffee position, making coffee for my home group. I was just scared to death. You know, like, oh, my God, yes, whatever, because obviously anything that I'm doing, I'm screwing up. And thank God for that, and thank God for the old-timers in my home group who just loved me, you know, just loved me till I could love myself, because I certainly didn't love myself when I came in here. I was full of shame. Shame, remorse, guilt, just full of it, full of it. Thank God for the fourth and fifth step. So I started going through the steps with a sponsor. I started getting that relief. And by 3 months, you know, the obsession was gone, was lifted. I didn't have, you know, didn't have that restlessness, irritability, you know, all 24/7. And at about 3 months, I had a miscarriage. you know? And this was the time when I first heard God in my life, first time. And I was in the doctor's office, and she, it was a checkup, and she said, we have no heartbeat, you know? And she said, I'll be right back, you know? And so I knew the baby had died. And that was the grace of God, because I was not in any shape to have a baby. And, you know, it just wasn't in the cards for me. And I remember at that moment looking at her desk, and I heard this, well, this thought came. It's not like I heard God, right? But it's this thought that I know is not mine. And that's how I know that God, it's a God thought, and it's not Carolina's thought. It's like, whoa, where'd that thought come from? That's not me. And the thought was, now you have to do this for yourself, you know? Now you got to do this sobriety thing for you, not for this baby, not for your parents to get the heat off. Now you got to do this for you. And I remember going, wow. And having that feeling of like, okay, of making that third step decision, you know, of making that decision right then. And it was right around the time I was doing the third step with my sponsor, you know, it's crazy. It was like, you know, got to do this. I'm going to do this. I'm going to do this, you know, because there's times I'd be like, maybe I've overreacted to all this. I'm 21. Do I really need to go to meetings? I mean, come on. Really? Maybe it wasn't that, you know, it wasn't that bad. I remember telling my sponsor at like 5 years sober, I didn't really have a low bottom. And she laughed in my face. She was like, are you delusional? Yes. Answer is yes. You know, and so yes, yeah, so I had that miscarriage, man, but you know what? That was so the grace of God. I didn't need that baby. That baby did not need me. That's the truth. That baby did not need me in the state that I was in. So I continued to do the work. You know, it was hard, and it was a hard time for me, and I cried a lot. I punched a lot of pillows. But man, I continued to do. I did the fourth and fifth step with my sponsor. And when I did that fifth step, I did feel the promises start to come true. The fifth step promises that said I can start to look the world in the eye. I think that's the fifth step promises. You know, that I'm kind of like walking hand in hand with my creator. Like, I was like, okay, I felt the higher power closer, you know, just like from all the way up here to like, okay, higher power's here now, right? I've done this deal. I felt like I was a part of AA. I was going to, you know, going out to dinner with the home group afterward. They were all old people, you know, probably my age. But, you know, they were all old people on Friday night, and here I am going to, like, Applebee's with them. Ooh, fun, right? But I did it, man. I was willing to do it, you know, and that stuff saved my butt. I can't tell you what of any of all the things that I've done that helped me to stay sober. It's like all of them, you know, all three sides of that triangle, the steps, the fellowship, and service, you know, is like that. Those are the three things, man, you know, and I can tell any time in my life and in my sobriety when I have not been in a good place. I didn't do it at the time because I wanted to be in my own delusion that I was managing things well. But if I did an inventory of my life on those three sides of the triangle, I guarantee you they were real small on a lot of them, right? Wasn't really doing, hadn't done a fourth and a fifth step, a real thorough one in a while, or not sponsoring as many people, or, you know, not going to dinner with people afterwards, not being a part of the fellowship, not saying yes, you know? Because after a time of being sober, my story is, you know, I got the job, I got the master's degree, I got, you know, restored relationships with my family, made amends, you know, got a lot of the promises from this program, you know, and, you know, was into service, was going, doing a lot of taking meetings to Tucker's where I was naked, and, you know, I was doing a lot of stuff in AA, I was doing a lot of stuff, and then, one thing that I struggle with a lot is the money, property, and prestige, you know, came, you know, coming in, you know, and it's all driven by, I don't think I'm good enough. In AA, You know, I don't think I'm sober now, but I'm not good enough. You know, still not good enough. I still have that tape going, that core false belief driving my behavior. And so I start chasing money, property, and prestige in Alcoholics Anonymous. And so I'm chasing the jobs. I'm chasing the promotions. I'm relocating. I had gotten married by this time. I'm relocating my family. I've done that twice. I've relocated twice in sobriety, chasing the job, you know, chasing the, if I just have this, I'll be good enough. You know, if I have, again, if the storefront looks pretty, I'll be good enough, you know, and if I have the right car, if I have the right house, if I have the right amount of money in my bank account, then I'm going to be good enough. And what I found is that's all a lie. You know, just like the disease saying like, oh, just drink me, you'll feel better. It's not true. It's the same thing, you know. And so at 16, my dad died in 2010, and we had a tumultuous relationship, as you can imagine. And by 2016, I just had a full-blown nervous breakdown, you know, 16 years sober. And I... what had happened was once my dad had died, I got mad at God. You know, I had established this beautiful relationship with this higher power, and I was using it every day to stay sober for 10 years. And at 10 years, he takes my dad. As tumultuous as the relationship was, he still took something from me, is what I was saying. You know, God took something from me. So screw you, God, right? And so that's what I did. I gave him the middle finger. And didn't really pray for about a year. Then I kind of got back into some level of prayer. And okay, fine. But I was running the show. I had worked my way backwards through the steps to where I was the power now. And that happened once he died, right? Once I felt this sort of betrayal from God, I took the reins back. I took the power back. And now in the second step, I'm the power that's going to restore me to sanity. You know, and how are we going to do that? More money, more property, and more prestige. So I move up to Manhattan, northern New Jersey, take a job in Rockefeller Center. You know, that's going to fix it. And what happens then? AA starts to not become a priority. I go to meetings when it's convenient. You know, I pray when it's convenient, or it's, you know, I do a 10th and 11. I do 10 and 11 when it's convenient, 10, 11, 12. I have one sponsee. I was used to sponsoring multiple people. I have one at that time for a while. And a job that took me all over Latin America and away from my family. And that was a spiritual bottom, a spiritual, emotional, mental, and physical bottom. And one day I just couldn't do anything. I couldn't work. I couldn't move. I was in a depression that I couldn't tell you how dark it was. Other than I did kind of want to take my life away. I thought it would be better if I just wasn't here, you know, 16 years sober. And that's what letting up, resting on my laurels, you know, resting on my past achievements. Well, I've been sober this long, you know, let the newcomers do that stuff. I don't need to do that stuff. It got me to a nervous breakdown. So, but I'm so incredibly grateful for that today because that, you know, I couldn't leave my house for a month. Couldn't work for 6 months, and I just went to a lot of meetings. I went to IOP, 16 years sober, for depression. Yeah, that's winning. Hashtag winning. But what came out of that was going through the work at a level that I'd never gone through the work before. Doing a 4 and 5 that I think was like 30 or 40 hours long, you know, the fifth step with my sponsor, and really getting down to causes and conditions, you know. And what's my real fear, you know? And my real fear, it's all self-centered fear, you know? All self-centered, that you don't approve of me, you don't like me, therefore I'm not good enough, I knew it, I'll never be good enough. And all of that is false. All of it is false, you know? And we got to dispel a lot of old ideas that I still had 16 years sober, tons of old ideas. And through that fourth and fifth step, and I saw my character defects, whoo! Wide open. And I saw how the fear drives the resentment. The fear drives the dishonesty. If I'm afraid of what you think of me, then I got to lie to you. There's no other way. If I'm afraid of what you think, I got to lie to you so that you like me. You know? So it was like dominoes of these character defects of mine. And my sponsor showed me how the domino effect would go for me. How my character defects start to spark the next one. It sparks the next one. And I was like, oh my God. Right? Oh my God. Full knowledge of my condition. I'm so grateful of that. You know? God really showed me so much. And every time I'd be done, I thought I was done with sharing it with her. I'd go home and be there for the hour, and God would bring more stuff up. More stuff. Oh, remember this? Got to write this down. Oh, remember this from 16 years ago? Yep, write it down. So it just goes to show me I'm never done. I am never done here. You know, never done. And that was an amazing experience. And through all of that, I had a spiritual transformation, you know, one that lit the spark back in me for Alcoholics Anonymous, one that lit the spark in me for my own life, for others, you know, to realize that the way I was managing my life, I was the power. And the way I was managing it sober was I was managing it into the ground. My best ideas sober on my own self-reliance will have me run my car off the road and into a tree. That's just the truth for me. So today I have a real clear knowledge of my powerlessness and my unmanageability and my absolute need for a reliance upon a higher power every day. You know, I don't do it great every day. I'm still a brat sometimes. But oh my God, my life is so much better because I go, okay, God, help me. Okay, I'm getting ready to go into this conversation. Help me. Give me the words. Okay, God, we're doing this together. I'm doing this with God now. Never done life with God. I'm doing it with God now. And it's a whole nother level of peace and happiness. My life looks so different than it did 3 years ago. It looks fundamentally different. And I don't have the fancy job, and I don't have a lot of fancy things that I was chasing after, and I'm just fine, you know? I'm so fine, because the reliance has to come from the higher power for my happiness. It can't come from the outside things. So it's been a journey. It has been a journey, and I'm so grateful that I kept, you know, I had one of my sponsors in Richmond that I had in Richmond for a long time. She would tell me that the most spiritual thing on my body are my feet, because my feet take me to meetings and my feet take me to working with others. My feet take me to meeting with a newcomer. And I got to tell you, when I came back to Richmond, I moved back to Richmond after having this transformation and realizing, you know, that I needed to make some changes in my life. And I got into service, some kind of big, working with others, that 12th step. And that is what saved me. That truly is what has saved me, is working with others. I've had some amazing women come into my life, you know, and I work, you know, the more I work with women, the happier I am. I mean, it's a formula that works. Bill had it perfect because it's from God. It's like, hey, get out of yourself, you'll be happier. You know, stay at home, sulking and in yourself, you're going to be miserable. So today, you know, what I do is I try to help others. I come out here to share. I really don't like speaking, but I just do it, and because I say yes today. And thank you guys for saying yes and coming to this meeting tonight. Thanks, I'll pass.